Siren Radio.
Exceptionally wonderful. Gabriella, weather forecast for Lincoln, please, from Gibraltar.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 10 degrees centigrade, lows of 6 degrees centigrade, and it will be a day of light cloud and a gentle breeze.
Fantastic. And what were you doing with Ellie Sample, who, of course, a much known fine midweek driver and indeed director of communications, no less, at the University of Lincoln in Gibraltar a matter of hours ago?
Well, I actually bumped into Ellie the day before at the careers fair because it dawned on me when I saw a couple of university stores. I was like, oh, I bet Ellie's here for the career.
Wow, so, that's deductive logic. That's what you call ace journalism.
Like, so I better find the University of Lincoln store. That was very busy, which I'm happy to say. Mm-hmm. A lot of students took prospectuses and signed their names down for opening.
Did they know what they were signing up for? Or was it just a case we just wanted to get them in? A bit like the First World War, really.
Yeah, maybe, but... after wait for a while, I got to speak to Ellie, and then we met up last night for dinner at the Rock Hotel, and it was such a lovely evening that we actually got to sit outside in the nice sun.
So just like Lincoln, really?
The UK's been having lovely weather, hasn't it?
It's not today. I tell you, it's like Los Angeles here. You know, I mean, we were hearing yesterday from Annette Andre that, there would have been big sort of dodgy weather in Los Angeles. Phil, of course, was very worried that it would rain on his wedding day. I tell you, Phil, you've got nothing to worry about. You're a midweek driver, so is Lily Holliman. Or, so the weather was a done deal. I mean, I don't know why you were fretting, honestly. But what is the...
That's very kind. In fact, it was said by one of our officiants at the wedding that we had nothing to worry about as well. But it worked out even better than that. We could not have rain the morning of the wedding because we were all being transported in this vintage vehicle that is not allowed to travel on wet roads. But we did get rain. It started to rain the moment it dropped us off at the venue for the reception after driving us around all morning. So it was the perfect time for a little drizzle at that point.
Phil, timing and radio.
Unless you're the driver, unless you have to park up, I guess. Would you have been able to go in the rain on the way back to the depot?
No.
but speaking of drizzle, I must take exception to your forecast there. I actually have it a little bit warmer for you today than Gabriella did, though I do see rain scattered throughout the afternoon, evening, and even tonight.
Far more optimistic in America.
Well, that's why, obviously, Mr. Cohen is doing so well. Looking ahead, because we'll talk about this with respect to Richard Fitzwilliams in a few seconds' time, the final score, Richard Fitzwilliams, 7 out of 10 in terms of the categories nominated. Richard actually blew it. Richard, why? I mean, 3-0 down now.
I got Richard down 8. But because I know there was one of them where he put, which was sort of half right and half wrong. Also.
No, I took the first choice in every case, Ben.
That was cruel. I gave him the benefit of the doubt.
He said best picture was Roma, and then he said, or even Green Book. Yeah. No, you can't take that. Best picture was Roma, and he was wrong completely. Yes. Best actress, Glenn Close.
But I was wrong too. even though I told you on the show that it was going to be Green Book, and then I voted, and then I predicted Roma. Because at the last minute, I thought that the politics, the backlash against Green Book was going to be too severe to overcome. But I underestimated the power of Octavia Spencer, the producer.
And
anyway,
of course,
we'll get into that with Richard. Yeah.
And of course, the fact that Lily Holliman had predicted that Green Book was going to win. Yes. I mean, you got to go with this.
We got to take these predictions seriously, right? I mean, she's the first person I ever knew to predict that Trump would be president. The moment Green Book comes out, she predicts it to be Best Picture. I mean, she's the one that you need to get the lottery numbers from, quite frankly.
I think combination. Phil, we have been joined by Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy, Jasmine Foley. How are you, Jasmine?
I'm really good, thank you.
Fantastic. Second part of the great campaign that we set up here to make you Miss Universe, Galaxy, etc. Quick question that we actually had from indeed the current holder of the Miss Lincolnshire title, of course, big fan of yours, Chloe Rose. You met her recently. Anything to do with chocolate?
No, it hasn't. I wish it was to do with chocolate so I could eat lots of Galaxy chocolate, but no, it isn't.
It's a thought. Phil Lynn, as director in America, what advice would you like to give or what questions would you like to put? And Gabrielle, feel free to join in this to the current holder of Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy when she's not doing fantastic work for the New Theatre Royal Lincoln and a whole heap of other bits and pieces. That is Jasmine Foley.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the responsibilities of Miss Lincolnshire Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy. There's so much geography in play in that title. You know, I don't know where her jurisdiction actually ends.
Yeah. So I mean, would it go over to Gibraltar as well? I mean,
it's endless.
Mrs. Lincolnshire Gibraltar Galaxy? You know, I don't know. Talk to us about it briefly, Jasmine. What's happening here? Explain what you're doing and what we'll be doing next week.
So I've been doing lots of work in the lead up. So I've been doing a lot of community work and charity work, and just a lot of preparation for next Friday. So it's a week tomorrow that I'll be competing in the UK final, and all the lucky winners of each category in the UK final will go to Orlando, Florida in August, where they'll compete in the International Galaxy Pageant.
And of course, the fantastic charity that benefits from all this work is
the Christie Cancer Charity.
Christie Cancer Charity. So, a round of applause for the.
I was going to guess that the charity that benefits is the Midweek Drive.
Oh, we're a charity.
No, it's a lot long story.
We accept any donations. Anyone's welcome. Exactly. In the form of sweets
we'll
or chocolate
places. Gabriella, any questions you'd like to put to Jasmine?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting, but how are you looking forward to the final and what's going to be happening at that final? So tell us a bit what you're going to be doing.
So it's really exciting. I can't wait to actually do it. It's my first ever pageant. So there's an interview. So we have rehearsals during the day for this evening, which is the actual competition. But during the day, we also have interviews with the judges, where I'll be talking about all the things that I've been doing in the run up to the pageant. So it'll be nice to share that with them. And then in the actual competition at night time, we do different on stage walks for different categories like fashion wear, evening wear. And then we have just a big announcement at the end of the.
Now, when you said you do different on-stage walks,
yeah.
I mean, is that like the Monty Python Ministry of Silly Walks? You're too young to remember that, but you know, where you actually have to do a different shaped walk for each particular sort of thing. So there's one which kind of like straight. There might be a goose step march in there. Who knows?
Well, nothing quite like that, but the walks for each category are a little bit different, so it does take quite a bit of practice.
Phil, any advice from your own point of view?
Is that what we're talking about? I've covered a lot of pageants because I cover the Miss Gibraltar pageant, and I know that they have like Miss Catwalk and like evening wear. So I think it's like, doesn't your walk depend on kind of like what you're wearing? Like if you have a fashion round, usually your walk is a lot more punchy, whereas if you have an evening wear round, you usually walk a lot slower, more elegantly. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, definitely. That's exactly right. Yeah. So fashion wear is much more of like a bouncier walk, with, like you said, a bit more punchy. And then evening wear, you have to go very, very slowly. It's almost like you go in
like Grace Kelly Dalek speech, perhaps. Yeah, one of those.
I've seen the girls do the slow-mo evening walks, and it's a talent in itself because you're using this massive dress. So many tripping hazards to go with it. I don't know if the stage has stairs, but if it does, it's always like a bit of that moment. And they just have to really kind of like prolong it as they go around the stage.
Yeah, and I do have steps as well that I need to conquer. Oh, yeah. And with it being my first one, I haven't had any practice on these steps yet. So let's hope that I make it safely down the steps.
What are you doing at the New Theatre Royal Lincoln? You should be doing practicing on stage, that sort of basis.
Yeah, well, Natalie has said that I can get on stage and do it, so I think I'll have to do it in front of her before I go and get her eye for how it looks as well.
And we checked out earlier that, of course, you have seen Miss Congeniality with William Shatner and Sandra Bullock.
So yeah, of course.
Very good.
Obsessed with William Shatner, you
are. It'll help. Sorry, Phil, you might have one or two comments.
Well, no, that was my only bit of advice. Unlike Gabriella, I have never covered any pageants. I know almost nothing about pageants, which, of course, doesn't mean I'm not incredibly willing to learn. But my only advice would have been to watch Miss Congeniality. I guess my question though would be, so Mrs. Galaxy, how does the idea first occur that this is something that you want to pursue? Does someone say to you, this is a good idea, or had you seen the pageant in the past? What's the, how does this happen?
So my sister-in-law has competed in pageants before, and I'd seen some pictures of her competing, and I'd always thought about doing it, but I thought about it first when I was at school, and I don't think I'd have had the confidence then to compete. So it's just been something that's always been there in the back of my mind, that I would, kind of like a bucket list thing that I've always really wanted to do. And now that I've got a bit older and my confidence has grown, I thought it was just the right time to do it.
That's everything about that is impressive, especially that you already have a bucket list. I just turned 50. I think it's probably time I start to write mine.
You definitely need a bucket list.
So pageant is going on my list right now. because I, Gabriella, want to be the queen of, I want to be the queen of the catwalk, or whatever it was you just described. That sounds fantastic.
Well, there are pageants for men, so why not get involved?
Why not? Exactly. Why not, indeed?
There is a male pageant for Gibraltar, so you can enter that one.
There's a what?
There is a male pageant in Gibraltar, and we also have a Miss Gibraltar too, which we send to Mrs. Universe.
Well, Gabriella, you've covered so many pageants. Can you find one for me that would allow me to not only walk the catwalk, but to walk the catwalk with my cat walking on my shoulder while I walk the catwalk?
That's a winning shot, I think. That's nailing it. Yeah, Gabriella, it's over. I mean, Ben is just choking with emotion. I mean, it'll happen. That's the important thing.
That's not emotion.
Exactly. That's okay. Phil, last two questions for Gabriella, please.
Gabriella, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this week?
I have, thank you.
Always good to hear from you. Can I enjoy speaking with you again next week?
Hopefully, yeah, next week.
And we did a tribute, obviously, to the late, great Peter Tork recently. We lost another great singer, of course, from a band not quite as famous as the Monkees, but that Tork. And there's so much to pack into the production. Honestly, we'll do a fuller Tork tribute in a matter of time. And those other bits and pieces. Oh, sorry about this. It's obviously something's decided to go off, which is just it was the sound of rain.
Easily 30 seconds. That, and you just not notice.
That's the joy of wearing headphones. Anyway, I think that's quite that one. Don't I? Let us move on. Richard Fitzwilliams, welcome to the production. How are you?
I am extremely well. A very lively week. Very enjoyable. I was even in Brighton yesterday at some odd 18 degrees or whatever, which was unusual. Wow. Pretty mildly in February, as indeed was the fact that a ceremony that could have been, or potentially, was going to be a very tricky one for the Academy, went off, I thought, extremely well.
apart from, of course, from the fact that, as we discovered last night, and we discussed this quite extensively, sorry, Olivia, it wasn't hilarious at all. And Glenn Close certainly didn't find it hilarious. Quickly, looking at the numbers that we actually got here before Phil Linus shares the airwaves with yourself, Richard, to reminisce and talk about the Oscars. Phil came out with 9 out of 10. He didn't get Best Picture, did get Best Director, got
well,
Best Actress.
Yes,
I know. The point is, you scored 7 out of the key there. Best Actress, actor Rami Malek, best supporting actress Regina King. In fact, the only one that was the only one that Phil didn't get in his list of 10 was indeed Roma. From that point of view, a few odd ones. He didn't get best visual effects for Avengers: Infinity War. That went to First Man. He didn't get best sound editing. That went to Bohemian Rhapsody. Likewise, best sound mixing, which also went to Bohemian Rhapsody. But that wasn't being challenged by both of you. So the 10 categories that you had actually given to us, I'm afraid Phil Linus now leads 3-0, Richard.
Oh, dear, dear. I mean, how will the future years pan out, one wonders? But I have to say, I cannot grudge it simply because the part of the bum of the evening were the surprises, and the surprises were not anticipated by anybody or by most people, and quite frankly, good for him for getting Olivia Colman, because the whole idea that Glenn Close, who was togged up like a consort to, or a sort of queen consort in gold, was going to walk in with 2,500 new Academy members, 2,400 to be precise, in the last 3 years, and for a performance in a bad film, where she was very good, but I mean, it wasn't anything special. And you had Olivia Colman giving this brilliant performance, which was absolutely mesmerizing, especially to see it again, to see the ups and downs, the funny bits, the sad bits, the basic Queen Anne absolute basket case, and yet somehow keeping the country together. That she would be beaten, or Lady Gaga would be beaten, or even indeed let's Aparicio would be beaten. Outrageous.
Yeah,
and
well,
it didn't happen.
It did, and that's the important thing. Ben, you were the official arbiter. Was that a fair result, did you feel? I mean, having looked at the whole thing?
There was one I disagreed with you on, Alex, and that was Richard's, where, in fact, I gave you 8 out of 10, Richard, not 7, because I'm kind.
Which one was this, Richard?
So that was the double one.
Was that... We can't go into this now, you know. It's like
it was best actress. It was best actress where he said initially that we'll win Glenn Close.
You had to take the one that he said.
But Olivia Colman was on there.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Right. No. So actually, it was 8 out of 10, I think.
Richard, this is why I felt fairly strong that Olivia Colman would pull the upset and win. It's because the Academy has been, over the last several years, so fond of spreading awards around to the different films that receive a lot of nominations. And it struck me, looking at the field, that the only award it could win would be Best Actress. And what one would be more fitting for it. So I felt that gave her a really strong bit of momentum. And then the other thing about it was that the Academy is made up of a lot of actors, and they do have a tendency to reward the character actors and actresses who are finally given an opportunity to really shine in a lead, especially if there's the sense that this will be their one time for that. So that's why I picked her. But with Best Picture, Richard, I think I even mentioned on the show a few weeks ago that I thought Green Book was going to win. And yet even I predicted Roma because I just thought that the backlash that Green Book had been facing was going to end up overwhelming its chances.
And indeed, I have to say, I mean, just taking the Telegraph for just one example, the critic Robbie Cullen, the worst Oscar winner since Crash and so forth, and then all the controversy we've been having, yes, the intricacies of that and various misfortunes that the film has had. Yes, I mean, it's very exciting. I mean, I read essays on why A Star Is Born was, as it were, well, I mean, the star went from the very, very start. I think it's one of the most extraordinary movies, rather like perhaps Dunkirk, but for reasons that are far, far less obvious. A movie initially, the very beginning of all season, you think it's going to do extremely well, and it's got so much that it's going for. It's about show business. Heavens, I'm in Hollywood rather like La La Land, except that I realized that in the subsequent weeks, whenever I met someone, they'd hiss at you, if not actually want to physically assault you, if you said that you liked it. And so I really felt that in the case of A Star Is Born initially, with two first-class performances, I really, really felt for Bradley Cooper, because if you direct a film, if you co-produce a film, you co-write, and you're also involved in the writing of some of the songs, and you give a performance like that, you deserve more than that very, very memorable part of the Oscar ceremony where I loved that.
I think that a lot becomes clearer. I had not known this, but when the Academy, in the wake of the Dark Knight controversy, when the Dark Knight did not receive a Best Picture nomination, the Academy went back to its pre-1944 rules, which allows up to 10 nominations. But they also went back to the voting rules before 1944, which means that they run a preferential ballot. For many decades, the winning film, as is the winner in all other categories, is the selection with the most first place votes. That's how you decide who best actor is. That's how you decide who best actress is. But in the case of Best Picture, everyone submits a ranked list, ranking the films, in this case, 1 through 8. And the film's first place votes all go into piles. And the film with the fewest first place votes gets eliminated. And those ballots then move to whoever they picked as the second best on their list. And so on through the rounds, so that each round, the film with the least few first place votes gets eliminated. And what this means ultimately is that the winner for Best Picture is not the film that initially has the most first place votes. Rather, it's the film that is disliked the least that gets named Best Picture.
I have to say, Phil, I must congratulate you on explaining your system so macabrely complicated that I could only compare it to the, it was a political problem in Europe, the Schleswig-Holstein question. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it was so complicated that it was said only three people understood it. They were all academics. One had died, one went mad, and one had forgotten it. It really is hell to read the Academy's system of choosing the best picture and to try and put it in your mind as to how it works. I thought that was a remarkable effort on air. I was just about understanding what you were saying, and it is terribly complicated, and it does seem to mean that we might well get a very, very different result. But I'm very surprised that with A Star Is Born completely removed so early from all the awards, because it's applied to all of them, including the BAFTAs and the Globes, that film, which I absolutely loved it. The other thing I was going to ask you, because I would love a bit of background here. I was wrong, obviously, in predicting Roma, but the reason Roma didn't win, this is I'd just like to go into for a minute, because Steven Spielberg launched, as you know, an attack on Netflix and said that he didn't think Netflix films should be in competition at the Oscars, and indeed this echoes of the rows at Cannes about this. And I just wondered whether it occurred to me in the Oscar So White controversy with Beasts of No Nation, which I think was the first feature that Netflix opened. They opened in 32 cinemas. That made that it meant it qualified for consideration. But Elba didn't win, which is absolutely outrageous, or indeed wasn't even nominated, which was simply bizarre for a superb performance. But I just wondered whether there still is, of course, the standoff between the cinema chains of the studios and Netflix. And Netflix poured some, like reportedly, $30 million, I gather, billboards up everywhere, $30 million, into promoting it, which must beat Shakespeare in Love, though I don't know if it does in real terms, because that was an extraordinary effort by you-know-who, and of course it succeeded. But I just wondered why you thought Roma had lost. Of course, we don't know the viewing figures, because Netflix will never release them. We know that the box office takings are tiny. Presumably it's opened in more cinemas, because it opened in a few just to qualify it. But did the... I mean, I loved the film. I thought it was beautiful, a semi-autobiographical movie that was pitch perfect and with a lot of very, very moving scenes, and also scenes from the point of view of the indigenous nanny, superbly played by Letizia Aparicio, but rather nice, they gave Maria de Tavera a nomination for playing the mother, and it was a perfect film. Seeing it a second time in a cinema with beautiful sound, I rarely mention this especially, but I was really, really, as it were, sucked into Roma's vortex. Why, in your opinion, did it not win?
Well, I think, again, the first answer would be this preferential balloting system. I think if it was on the older voting system where it was just the amount of first-place votes on a first ballot, it would have won. So that's one thing. The second is that, again, the Academy seems so committed to spreading awards around. And you have two films that politically have their heart in messages that the Academy wants to support. And I got the feeling that a lot of members say, well, it has its own category. It has foreign language film.
But they can't. How can you break out of that? No film ever has to win Best Picture.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if any film will. I don't think an animated film. We know that there have been animated films in history that were the best films of the year that they came out, that are masterpieces of cinema. But as long as you have a Best Animated Feature category, you will never see an animated film win Best Picture. Only
but if
Best
that
Animated
actually,
Picture.
Just to ask another point on this, this basically, because very occasionally, obviously, as we well know, performers do, in foreign language films, very occasionally win. And there have only been 10 nominated for Best Picture, and of course, Crouching Tiger, the Hidden Dragon one, got 10 nominations, as Roma did. But of course, none have ever won. But to actually lock, I mean, what I was wondering was the 2,400 extra members of the Academy, a large number of those are from abroad. I would have thought, I mean, the obvious intention is to make it more diverse, but I see that persons of color, 16%, women, 31%, it's a long way to go. But the point I'm making is that it could be that with far more non-American or non-English-speaking members, we may, and I hope we do, get more Best Picture nominees from other countries, because after all, the Oscars is supposed to cover an international.
And it
suite.
Does, Richard, as you said, it's the biggest show on earth, and I think that's a wonderful sort of point to actually say.
It's the biggest, it's the oldest, but the most extraordinary thing was then to find it so defensive and to find them making in the run-up to the award ceremony. Incidentally, I haven't heard Phil's actual comments on the evening and how he thought it went with the speeches.
Well, I mean, Phil, I don't want to sort of put words into your mouth, but we only have 2 minutes left, so what would you say to say? Keep it brief.
Well, it's just like being on the awards. You're going to play me off. I thought that overall the show ran well without a host. However, if they do this again, they need to think through some things. There are a couple things that a host brings to the table, like a writing staff. This show needed a writing staff, or get rid of all the introductory banter altogether. It was the most banal introductory banter between presenters I have ever seen. Because there was no writing staff.
I know you were pushed for time, but I have to ask if you heard Joanna Lumley at the BAFTAs.
don't reopen old wounds. Do not reopen old wounds.
The other thing that I brought up on my show, and I'm not saying that every recent host or the people they were looking at the host would be able to accomplish this, but there was much made of, again, this year, some of the astonishing people who were overlooked during the in memoriam section, including
Stanley Donen, for goodness sake.
Well, and the excuse that's given is, well, it was announced that day that he had died, but also Carol Channing, a 2-time Academy Award nominee. If they're not going to honor their own, if they're not going to remember their own, who are they going to honor? But it occurred to me that that's one of the reasons you want to have a host, because you do have a host who is then able to come out and say, for example, before the presentation for the music awards, is able to say, And of course, tonight we also remember the great Stanley Donen, the great Carol Channing,
Phil, I'll do it with you next year, okay? You've asked, I'll do it with you. If the Academy asks us both, I'll be there. You can have a British and an American sort of take on the whole thing. I can keep the times going. You can actually do various other things.
I think we've been very, very cruelly restricted to time, Alex.
Well, that's, yes. Don't blame me, blame Cleveland. Actually, that's Cleveland, America. Is eating dinner for breakfast?
If you and I hosted any show, Alex, it truly would be just two men talking about celebrity deaths. I mean, that really is all we would ever get around to.
Well, hats off certainly to Mark Hollis, lead singer, of course, of Talk Talk, and of course, the late, great Peter Talk. Ironic indeed. Phones coming through in all sorts of other bits and pieces. We're going to be finding out, is eating dinner for breakfast the key to a better, healthier day?
And you're cutting the Oscars for that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's
At what point in the show does Richard get to ask me all the questions he has about my wedding?
In a week's time.
Well, I mean, I really feel that, Alex, you deliberately, cruelly, and maliciously tampered, not with the results of our poll, but tampered with the time, because I haven't had a chance talking about Olivia Colman, Rami Malek, Regina King. I mean, these speeches, you know, they were very good.
Who do we talk to at Siren FM about Richard and I getting on?
We'll get it sorted. We're getting calls from all sorts of bits and pieces there.
The possibility of... I just wanted to put a
5 seconds, Richard.
Final thought to Phil.
Three.
About the fact that there was no host.
Two and a half.
It meant that we talked about the films more. I rather felt that that might be considered.
It'll come through. Take care, Richard. Has it been a good, brief telephonic chat for your good self?
Unforgettably, ruthlessly brief.
We will speak.
Very best to Phil, which I hope he got, that you both got on Facebook, because I've been sending all the best.
Phil Linus and Richard Fitzwilliams, happy trails!
When the world and I were young, just yesterday, life was such a simple game a child could play. It was easy then to tell right from wrong, easy then to tell weak from strong, when a man should stand and fight or just go along. But today there is no day or night, today or tasted fear. It was easy then to tell truth from lies, selling out from compromise, who to love and who to hate, the foolish from the wise. But today there is.
So apart from clearly the excitement of Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy, which we'll talk about again in a few moments' time, do we ever think about when we're eating? And I say that again, when we're eating. Is eating dinner for breakfast the key to a better, healthier diet? There was an old maxim which said, breakfast like a king, supper like a pauper, and so on. And to address this, we're delighted to welcome live from New York, where it's something like, I think, 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. in the morning, Dr. Michael Crepane, author and medical director of the Dr. Oz Show. Good morning, Dr. Crepane.
Good morning. It's 3:30 a.m.
3:30 a.m. So, well, kudos for actually staying up. Now, have you already sort of planned your three-course dinner now at 3:30 a.m. that you're going to sort of engage in? And talk to us about this little research. Is eating dinner for breakfast the key to a better, healthier lifestyle?
Yeah, so a lot of times we think about what we eat. Actually, we think about it all the time, right? But we rarely think about when we eat. And what we found is that it's actually really important. When we eat is actually just as important as what we eat. And it all has to do with something called our circadian rhythm, which is our body's clock. And we think about it a lot when we think about sleeping, right? Or if we think about jet lag, we know that our circadian rhythm is out of whack. But it turns out that our circadian rhythm not just regulating our sleep, but it also regulates our metabolism. So our metabolism actually changes throughout the day and actually expects us to eat early when the sun is shining, so eat more in the morning, and to fast when it's dark overnight.
In the studio, we've got three fabulous folk. I mean, Ben, if we turn to you first, I mean, you're an undergraduate. I mean, clearly sleep habits can be all over the place. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I find it quite interesting. I imagine probably most times people end up in this situation where they end up eating dinner for breakfast, probably when they're flying, or flying long haul. And I don't know, for me personally, it's not something I've ever thought about doing. Like you say, I think it's to do with my body clock, but also what type of meals you need to have. So there's a lot of high-energy foods in the morning, high protein or high, lots of sugar, essentially, in some cases, to give you energy
disaster
for the day.
Disaster, sugar is the new nicotine. You can't be going down that line.
I know, but that's traditionally what it is, through cereals and things like that.
I mean, again, Dr. Crepane, from your own perspective, clearly it's a case of what we eat, and it's not going to help at all if your breakfast consists of lots of sugary foods and fizzy drinks and so on.
That's right. So that's why we say eat your dinner for breakfast. So we think you should eat most of your calories before about 3 p.m., so making breakfast and lunch your biggest meals of the day. And if you're going to do that, we don't want you eating traditional breakfast food, so we don't want you eating sugary cereals and pastries. We want you eating real food. Mm. So that's what we typically eat at dinner, right? We eat it late. So there's nothing wrong with eating dinner-type foods for breakfast. So one of my favorite breakfasts is cold pasta, or my co-author, Mike Roizen, his favorite breakfast is salmon. So there's nothing wrong with eating those foods in other cultures. Like in Japan, they have no problem eating fish for breakfast. So there's no reason we shouldn't all have that.
See, I started off this morning with a banana and a raw carrot. I don't know where that puts me on the
whole thing.
It's
going to give you the best breath, though, doesn't it? Fish for breakfast, I guess.
No, banana and a raw carrot.
Yeah, banana and raw carrot. That's
no fish there at all.
No, I was not about the Japanese, but...
Let's not go there. Eloise, thoughts from yourself. I mean, again, there's research from National Geographic. 3/4 often eat their biggest meal at dinner time later in the day. What's your circadian rhythm habit when it comes to food?
I tend not to actually eat until about 6 p.m., so I'm the total opposite.
You see, Dr. Crepane, from that point of view, what about folk who actually say, no, I just wait until 6 p.m.? I mean, is that good, or is it a case of we need to relearn our habits?
Yeah, it's really about relearning our habits. I actually used to only eat dinner as well. I used to eat at 6 or 7 or 8, and that would be my biggest and only meal of the day. But what we're seeing in the research is that eating more early is actually better for you in terms of having more energy, sleeping better, and losing weight. There's some really interesting studies, especially one from Spain, where they had people who were on a diet, and they had about 400 people in this experiment. And what they told them what to eat, and they had them eating lower-calorie meals. But when they divided them up into two groups, they found that the people who ate their biggest meal before 3 p.m. actually lost 25% more weight than the people who ate it after 3 p.m., and everybody ate the exact same number of calories. So that's why we say, looks like our circadian rhythm regulates our metabolism and actually changes the way we process food. So we always say a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, which is true in the laboratory, but it's not true in your body. Your body handles things differently. So a calorie is actually worth more when you eat it late at night compared to when you eat in the morning. So changing the way we eat is really important if we're going to be healthy and we're going to be in better shape. And it's actually not as hard as you think. So I've done it. I've flipped my days upside down. I've made breakfast and lunch my biggest meals of the day. And what I've found is that I'm not even hungry anymore at night. So sometimes I skip dinner completely. We don't say you have to do that. Just making dinner your smallest meal of the day is what we recommend. And it's incredibly, surprisingly easy because your hunger actually changes.
Jasmine, is this something you will be trying in the near future, or is it a thought that you might sort of think, oh, I might experiment with that to give myself more energy during the day as opposed to, you know, feeling at mid-morning, whatever?
Well, actually, growing up, we always had our dinner at about 4 p.m. Like, after I'd got home from school, that's when I'd have it, and that would be the last time I'd eat for the rest of the day. So I grew up not eating after that kind of time anyway. And it does get harder as you get older because obviously now I work full time, so I'm at work till 5 p.m. And then by the time you've got home and been able to prepare food. So I guess what would your advice be for people that might want to have their bigger meal in the middle of the day, but obviously you're at work, so you don't have that same preparation time as you have in the evening. What kind of recommendations would you give to be able to switch that around and do it that way?
Yeah, so the easiest way to do it is to do a little planning. So I love to cook. It's one of my passions, hobbies. I like to cook every day. So now I spend more time cooking in the evening and less time eating because I'm not eating much. But then I prepare what I'm going to eat for the next day so it's ready to go. And I found that some old-fashioned techniques are really great. So I bought a really old-fashioned thermos. Sometimes I'll make a big pot of soup. And then in the mornings before I go to work, I'll heat it up, put it in this thermos. And every single day that I do this, I burn my tongue because it's amazing how well these things work when I open it up 6 or 7 hours later. So just preparing things in advance.
I don't know, Dr.
It's a great way to be able to eat your larger meal.
I mean, Dr. Crapane, you've got your cold pasta, you've got your burning tongue. It's just a strange scenario on that basis. What to Eat When is the book that's actually around available, presumably around on all good websites and easily accessible?
Yes.
And what other website would you suggest people should perhaps go to find out about this fascinating insight, which, again, I know over the years we've had like the 2+5 diet, we've had sort of meat diets, we've had people saying this and various other bits and pieces. This thing which almost seems to be, again, flipping things together. Of course, it does mean we'll have to rethink our midweek drive meal next week. Technically, we should actually have it in the morning at 8 o'clock. I don't know how that's going to happen.
Is Toby Carver reopened then?
Right, we'll just have to wait and see. Where could people go? Would it be nationalgeographic.com initially for the survey?
You can go there. You can go to wenway.com. That's our website. You can follow us at wen.way on Instagram. And let me just add that you can also follow us on Facebook, too.
And Wenway is the way W-E-I-G-H or W-A-Y?
The way is W-A-Y.
It is Wenway. That's fine. Just wanted to correct because I wasn't sure talking about
Wenway. Let me just add one other thing. You don't have to do this every day, so we don't want you to not be social on the weekends or when you're going out with friends. If everybody's eating a big dinner, you can do it, you know, a couple times a week. It's okay to revert back to old habits. The studies show that in animals, at least, when they do it 5 days out of week out of seven, they do just as well as if they do it 7 weeks in a row. Well, you know, 7 days in a row.
We haven't even spoken about the Dr. Oz show, which is a whole new world from that point of view, and medical director of the again, Dr. Oz, nothing to do presumably with Australia or indeed the Wizard.
America, no, yeah. Neither of those. I don't think the show's on in the UK.
No, not yet. That's the key thing. You know, I think this is the start, Dr. Crapane, of actually global domination, clearly. I won't ask you what the weather's like in New York because it's now 3:43 a.m. I mean, hats off again to doing that. You know, one of our few rare correspondents. I mean, we just had Los Angeles at midnight, but I think actually New York at 3:43 is even better.
It's not often we have New York in the morning show, is it?
No. And again, that's why we're delighted to say, Dr. Crapane, many thanks for joining us. Will you be kind enough to join us again in the near future and keep us appraised of your dietary material and more?
Sure, anytime. Thanks for having me.
I think a round of applause for Dr. Crapane, please. Absolutely, that's polite British applause, claws coming across the Atlantic for you. Many thanks. Take care.
Thank you.
Jan Hammer and Crockett's theme. Okay, Arthur McKenzie, welcome to the programme. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad this morning.
Wonderful.
A bit grey though outside.
And Newcastle, I'm surprised, actually. I mean, you won last night, or at least the team did. I know you're not a major football fan. It's more sort of rugby from your perspective, and athletics. We've just been speaking to a chap in New York, Dr. Michael Crepane, who maintains that actually you should eat dinner for breakfast and have a better, healthier day as a result of that. You should reverse and flip your whole dietary things. As an athlete, Arthur, was that something which, I mean, he's clearly concerned about diet, but is that something where, yeah, actually you should go for a dinner for breakfast?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so.
Ben, he shares your scepticism.
Thank you.
Exactly. He shares your scepticism. And there was I, Arthur, thinking he'd be taking this call just as Irene has like literally a five-course meal there all lined up, and you're sort of just into the whole range of things. Exciting things. We have in the studio Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy just for a few more moments. And I know, have you ever met Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy in any incarnation, Arthur?
No.
I thought you might have written about the character appearing in an episode of The Bill or something from that point of view. But Jasmine, would you like to talk to us a little bit about the way in which Glitz and Glamour, your main sponsors there, we've promoted them again, are coordinating an event that you're doing this weekend as the last one before in a week and a bit's time, you will be doing this for real.
Yeah, so the last things that I've just got coming up now, Saturday morning, 10 till 12, I'll be at Glitz and Glamour Boutique helping girls pick their prom dresses. So that's Glitz and Glamour in Sleaford. So if anybody wants to come along, then it's just open for people to come in. And I'm really excited about it as well, because obviously I already had my prom a long time ago, so I picked my dress for that, and I've had my wedding now as well. So I've had those two main events where you get to pick an amazing dress. You know, they've all passed for me now, so I'm excited to help some other girls to do that.
Arthur, do you remember your prom night? We didn't have them, let's face it. We never had them. Prom nights were an investigation and an invention of the Americans that we kind of took in probably as a result of Back to the Future, which, curiously, was given two thumbs up, I hear, from Eloise. You were a keen Back to the Future fan. We got a social media message from Abigail that you were Back to the Future, you appreciated it.
Yeah, I actually went straight out and bought the
other two. So. Wow. So. Arthur, what's your thought for the day, possibly targeted at Jasmine Foley, who will be taking part in the final of the UK. It's the UK final.
UK final. Yeah.
So which other galaxies will you be up against?
So we're in different categories.
It's a cosmological question. Brian May would appreciate it.
Andromeda.
So, exactly. So would Mr. Cox.
So there's some different categories. So there's like a Miss category, Ms., Mrs. So I'll be against all the other Mrs. contestants. So they're from all around the UK. There's, you know,
would there be a Mrs. Tyneside galaxy?
I haven't seen that. No, I don't believe
there's an
there
opening
is.
Opening for Irene there, Arthur.
Come on, Irene.
Exactly. No, that's Eileen.
I know, but I'm sure we can make it Irene just for this one joke.
So then you just compete against people in your category. So there'll be a winner from each category.
A Mrs. Galaxy Brighton, perhaps.
Not that I've... No, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, no.
It's bad enough your football team having challenges with that sort of... It could be London, North London?
Hammersmith. Miss Hammersmith.
There must be Miss Hammersmith somewhere. openings in the market, perhaps, to actually be developed on that sort of point of view. Listen, good luck. It's going to be awesome. You will be awesome, Jasmine. And it's been a privilege sharing some thoughts with yourself. Of course, it doesn't finish because you're back for the Royal Radio in the very near future, wearing another hat. The hat, of course, of being Chief Executive Marketing Officer for the Lincolnshire New Theatre Royal.
Yeah.
New Theatre Royal Lincoln, to be precise. Always get that name confused. Natalie never forgives me. Never mind. Arthur, your thought for the day for Jasmine, perhaps. Let's say, what has emerged?
I've got a couple of thoughts. I think this one may fit, though. I've been thinking about it. The heart sees everything before the head can see anything.
Like that. Ooh, that's deep.
It maybe should be the heart feels everything before the head sees anything.
That's even better.
Yeah.
I mean, you see, this is what comes to me. I know, as so we love Ian to bits, but he's still a journalist at heart. You know, Arthur speaks from the heart.
Is Ian still in Spain?
Yeah.
Right. That's a very long holiday, isn't it?
The difference between me and Ian is I've got an imagination.
I mean, to be fair, that has crossed my mind over the years, but, you know, particularly when we start talking about Newcastle United, but still, there we are.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll just say that again. So the heart feels or sees everything.
The heart feels everything.
The heart feels everything.
Before the head can see anything.
Before the head can see anything.
I like that. I'm going to ponder motto. On that today.
I think exactly. It's a way forward, certainly from that
point. But you see, in this competition, whatever it is, you'll know immediately before it starts. You know, it's a fact, you know, our senses pick up on things far quicker than our head or our eyes observe. There's no doubt about it.
So the moment you go through the door, you'll realise you are number
one. The non-verbal, all of that body language, everything, and your thoughts that have gone through your mind beforehand as well. So yeah, the instinct is a fantastic thing, and we're trying to eradicate it, like with Facebook and all these things. But it's a very sharp thing to have.
Trust your instincts.
Yeah,
it's in the head. It's like I feel as though it's almost Arthur is like Pep Guardiola there, just giving that sort of final little pep up thing from that point of view. It's just fantastic. Jasmine, thank you for that. That's great. We'll allow various other bits of music to go. Eloise, any questions for Arthur? Such as, I mean, have you been to Newcastle?
I haven't, no.
Well, then you can ask Arthur what bits you should ever check out in Newcastle when you do a location report up there.
Yes, what's the best thing about Newcastle?
The fact that it's nowhere near London.
Well,
you can't knock that.
I'll tell you what.
His diplomacy levels are fantastic. You know, you got a girl from Hammersmith. Best thing about Newcastle, the fact it's nowhere near London.
No,
long time ago.
My family lives in London as well. Never mind Newcastle, it's the northeast generally in Northumberland. It's the best kept secret in Britain. And we want to keep people out of it, really. We want to keep it to ourselves.
Shall we build a wall, Arthur? I mean, maybe we can actually suggest...
We've already had one.
Of course, Hadrian.
The Hadrian's Wall.
That was... Maybe that's what Donald actually got the idea from, really. I mean, we built Hadrian's Wall to effectively keep those rebellious Scots to one side. Maybe we need one of the Londoners as well.
Well, the thing is, with Hadrian's Wall, everybody started to build houses with it, didn't they?
Well, yeah, it's a way forward. Have you ever been to Brighton, Ben? Oh, sorry.
Really, oh, well, really. That's a very silly question, isn't it?
No, not
if
really.
If I'm from Brighton.
You might well have been in your mind. Arthur, have you ever been to Brighton?
Brighton, yeah. Yeah, I've competed there a few times.
So, your thoughts about Brighton as a...
Oh, I like Brighton. Oh, I like it.
So, whereabouts in Brighton did you compete?
I competed at the National Police Championships there many, many years ago. And we stayed right on the front in a nice big hotel. It was lovely. I loved it.
I think it might be the Whitdean Stadium. Whitdean Stadium.
Whitdean, that's it.
That's where Brighton had the ground for 12 years. That's where Brighton played.
Well,
that's exactly where I competed.
I thought it was there, yeah. You
see, and it was the first time that I actually won all three events at the National Police Championships. I shot the discus and the hammer. I remember it well. It was a lovely day as well.
And do you have?
I like Brighton a lot.
I'm sorry, London's obviously lost out in the Arthur McKenzie list of things to do.
Oh well, yes.
Exactly. Take priority over London.
Somebody once called Brighton London by the sea, but I don't think it is really.
Well, a nicer version.
Yeah. Anyway, you're listening to Siren Radio, currently based in Lincoln, I think. But it is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. It is nearly 5 minutes to 9 o'clock in the UK. That's in Newcastle and indeed in Lincoln, England. It's amazing. In the second part of the programme, we're speaking to Dr. Chris Steele and Ian McIntosh about how vitamin D is very important. We've got the world's fittest man, Ross Edgy, who apparently swam around the United Kingdom, 2,000 miles he actually swam. William Sitwell was joining us as well. And we've got a feature on carers. And I know, Arthur, silly question this, but 5G, are you bothered about the emergence of 5G in terms of telephonic networks?
Couldn't care less.
Exactly. That's the kind of line we actually have. Eloise is going to put those last two questions to you. Go, Eloise.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Yeah, I've had a good giggle, yeah.
And will you be joining us again sometime?
I would hope so, yes.
Of course. Round of applause for Arthur McKenzie as ever. Yay! Joyous. I feel inspired just on that basis because the heart sees everything, feels everything, before the body does. Woundings and healings in the same breath.
Three kisses, an instant set open. With your eyes wide open and your hands at your sides. But it feels like I'm running in spite of your charms. Into your arms again. Into your arms. Yeah, it feels like I'm running.
Siren Radio.
And the weather today, highs of 10 degrees centigrade, lows of 6 degrees centigrade. And it's going to be a day with light cloud and a gentle breeze.
To
might seem a little bit unusual when we see such glorious weather as we're experiencing in this this wonderful summer come winter, etc. But 50% of British folks suffer from vitamin D-related ailments, including fatigue, depression, chronic pain and weakness. 83% of workers in full-time employment leave for work and return home in darkness during the winter months. So it does seem as though this is having a major impact in terms of our quality of life. And who better to actually address issues relating to quality of life than two fantastic individuals. First of all, an ace nutritionist and general all-round superperson, Dr. Chris Steele. How are you, Chris?
Hello, Alex. Hey, Alex, I'm no nutritionist. I'm a GP. But
GP, exactly. Yeah. It's, you can turn your hand to so many things. As I say, a superhero, Chris. That's the important thing. And also from Go Outdoors, the wonderful Ian McIntosh. How are you, Ian?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Brilliant. Chris, if we can turn to your good self first and foremost, because as I say, we've followed your fantastic input in so many ways. This does seem to be getting, it's like a 21st century illness that sort of is impacting us in terms of, you know, it's not good if we're not getting our right kind of a balance of sunlight.
Yeah, I mean, the vitamin D story is, you know, has become very hot in the past few years. For decades, you thought, well, vitamin D, it's needed for strong bones and strong teeth. But, you know, the experts are now discovering that vitamin D is implicated in so many different systems of the body that seems to be vital to every cell in the body. And certainly, you know, low levels of vitamin D have been implicated with heart disease, cancers, depression, muscle weakness, tiredness, dementia. An interesting one is multiple sclerosis. That's a condition that becomes more prevalent the further north you go. So you get more cases of MS in Scotland than you do in Cornwall. And of course, you know, look at the sunlight exposure. Less sunlight in the north, more in the south. So less sunlight, lower vitamin D levels, increased MS. And they found that there is a link between vitamin D and multiple sclerosis. So it's a fascinating vitamin that we all need. And the fascinating fact is you've got your own vitamin D factory, your skin. And your skin, when exposed to sunlight or daylight, produces vitamin D.
Indeed so. And is it a possibility of actually sort of using nutritional supplements to kind of support it as well? I mean, can that help if, you know, if the weather's really bad, etc., you think, oh, I can't possibly go out in the blizzard conditions?
Well, you can get vitamin D from your diet, you know, or oily fish, eggs and liver, but you'd, I mean, I'll give you an example. One expert said you'd have to have 2 helpings of oily fish every day to get your vitamin D levels at optimum levels. Of course, vitamin D supplementation. There was a research out, a report published only a couple of days ago showing that vitamin D supplements, you know, do not supply the sort of the doses that you need. So I think basically what you need to do is you get out in the sunshine. So it's free. I'm going to buy your vitamin D supplements, and you have a varied diet as well.
Well, these days, anything that actually sort of reduces the economic outlay can be a good thing. Now, Go Outdoors obviously produced this survey. 71% of all people average less than an hour a day outside during winter. Ian, if we can turn to your good self, were you surprised by that, or do you think, yeah, I'm surprised it was as high as an hour?
No, I'm not really surprised by that. I think people have a natural fear of the weather, and, you know, particularly in winter, you know, you just sort of, the instinct is to stay inside. But the old adage of, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad equipment. You know, with the right stuff, you can get out in any weather, and it doesn't have to cost the earth. You know, you just need a waterproof jacket, a bit of warmth, and some decent footwear, and you can get out there. And that doesn't have to be in national parks or into the, you know, the Lake District, Scotland. You can go to your local park, you can walk down your local canal, you can just even walk around the streets where you live. Being outside is the thing that's going to really benefit your health.
Chris, one of the great things about, of course, the Northeast is, apart from being the centre of civilisation, you've got some fantastic sort of areas like Northumberland and lots of walks there, even in Lincoln and Lincolnshire, lots of sort of areas from that perspective. Is it as simple as that? I mean, you talked about the body producing its own mini factory. I mean, our wonderful healing qualities from that point of view, actually making that effort to get out and about.
Yes, look, if you can just get out for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes every day, you're going to be boosting your vitamin D levels. And although, you know, the UK is one of the cloudiest countries in the developed world, you know...
It mirrors the political situation, Chris, obviously. That's the key thing.
I'm not getting involved.
No, exactly. Very sensible.
You know, therefore we must get outdoors. I tell my patients, look, if I sit there and tell them, look, I want you to go out and do a 20, 30 minute walk every day, they don't want to know. You know, I mean, the survey showed that 40% of people said that walking for up to 30 minutes a day was far too long, and they didn't want to do it, especially if the weather was bad.
But that's only 1,800 seconds, for goodness sakes.
Well, yeah. Okay, but you know, that's their reaction. So what I tell them to do, I say, look, I want you to walk out for 10 minutes. Walk out for 10 minutes. Mm. You've got to turn around and come back. So yeah. That's a 20-minute walk.
Exactly.
If I say, I want you to do a 20-minute walk, they don't want to know. And really, and just do it non-stop, come rain or shine, right? If you're doing that, you've got to start somewhere. If you're not exercising, you've got to start. So start with that 10-minute walk. And I tell patients, count the lamppost you walk by in that 10 minutes. Mm. And you'll find that over the weeks, you're passing more lampposts because you're walking faster, you're going further, and you're obviously becoming fitter. And exercise, I tell you, is as important as any medication you're taking, because exercise will reduce your risk of heart attacks, strokes, several cancers, blood pressure, cholesterol. The list goes on and on.
I can almost sense the theme from Rocky as he runs up the steps in the wonderful sort of movie to actually being echoed there. Ian, turning to your good self, what other activities are available to people with that? I mean, obviously, there's walking from that point of view, which is an ideal thing from that point of view. People want to sort of think about other sort of activities they can go about. I mean, what would you recommend?
I mean, for me, one of the best ways, it is a much more of a summer activity, one of the best ways of being outdoors is to go camping. Especially if you've got a family, for me there isn't any better way of spending time in the outdoors. You naturally will be out there. You know you're in the perfect, beautiful locations where you can go walking. So camping is great. The other thing I'd say is get a dog. Then you have to go walking.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's always dog walkers who are actually out there, so there is that sort of challenge as well that you could be faced with. Where can people go to find out further information? Would it by any chance be gooutdoors.co.uk?
It may be gooutdoors.co.uk, yes. And you'll find there's a blog on there. There's also some expert advice on which getting started in any activity you want to do, whether that's fishing, riding, climbing, walking, whatever you like. We've got it all covered. So, yeah, visit our website and our social media channels and you'll find all that information.
Well, certainly allowing for the northern aspects which you raised, Chris. Perhaps oot and a boot should possibly be used as a sort of theme from that point of view. Chris, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. Likewise, Ian, have you gentlemen had a reasonably interesting, healthy, vitamin D-oriented conversation with us today? Has it been okay for you guys?
Thanks, Alan.
Absolutely. Cheers. Yeah, great. Thank you. Great.
Well, then, hopefully we'll speak again in the very near future. Take care now. All the very best.
Thank you. Cheers.
It's a suicide rap, we gotta get out of war. better, fitter, faster, stronger, all of these positive words that are being used to ensure that we actually can maintain our fitness levels and indeed improve them. And who better to actually talk about the state of play with respect to the United Kingdom than a gentleman who not only has taken part in the world's longest staged sea swim with over 2,000 miles around Great Britain, but generally is just mega superheroic in so many ways. It's Ross Edgy. How are you, Ross?
Oh, bless you. What an introduction. I don't know about that, but that is quite an introduction. Thank you.
Well, Ross, the key thing, in association with this research from New Covent Garden Soup, we find that actually as a nation, despite the fact that couch potatoes have for many years been saying, oh, I can't be bothered with any of this sort of thing, we are actually getting out despite the weather. And actually, when the weather's as glorious as it is now, there's no excuse whatsoever to actually not start fitness work in February.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's the thing that we're finding, and certainly that the research revealed, that now 40% of people, the British public, are throwing themselves outdoors and trying to get outside. And I think the reason is, I think if you start looking at, you know, our ancestors and the anthropology of us humans, and even our place in the animal kingdom, we're not, you know, the biggest, we're not the strongest, we don't have, you know, big fangs and teeth, we're not ferocious or anything like that. But one thing that as humans are really, really, really good at is just adventure and exploration. It's one thing that we've always been great at, looking at, you know, great feats of endurance from Shackleton to Captain Webb, first guy to swim across the English Channel. And I think what we're seeing now is this shift of people sort of sitting at their desks, you know, 9 to 5, or you know, sitting on the sofa, and they think innately, there's these kind of like inbuilt mechanisms where they're thinking, you know, maybe I should go and swim that lake, you know, outside my house. Or maybe instead of running on a treadmill, I'm going to go and conquer that mountain that I can see outside of my bedroom. And that is what is so encouraging about the research, that we are seeing this shift and this outdoor revolution, which is amazing. Certainly coming back from the Great British Swim, it's nice to see that messaging now and people kind of taking it, and it's all relative. I'm not saying swim around Great Britain. I often say it's a niche sport. I don't recommend it to many people, but it's all relative. And if it's signing up to your first 5K run, or, you know, maybe go wild swimming, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all relative, but to get outside of your comfort zone.
Well, it's particularly interesting to find that we look at things like the Tough Mudder Challenge, 15% interest in that, colour runs, marathons, cycle-based challenges. I suppose, say, the payoff is we do get bonuses with respect to the serotonin and the feel-good side of things. So evolutionary-wise, it does sort of bode well for the species.
That is a brilliant point. Yeah, that for everything, when you start to look at, you know, running outside and running on changing gradients up mountains, you look at the smaller intrinsic muscles, you know, ligaments and tendons in the feet, and they're then working like Mother Nature intended. But equally, it's exactly what you just mentioned there as well, which is just this mental aspect, which I think is so often overlooked, the psychological benefits as well. So for me, it's both. And I think too often we treat the two as separate, and when you're in the gym, you might be working on, you know, strength, your body's ability to generate force, or cardiorespiratory endurance, you know, your stamina, your lungs when you're on the treadmill. But really, you know, when you look at, you know, almost like the ancient Greeks, to go off on a bit of a tangent, but they understood, like Plato, you know, he influenced so much of Western philosophy today, but also a celebrated wrestler, you know, back in the day. And it's so interesting that they understood that mind-body connection. And I think it's something that's slightly been lost now, but I feel that we're getting back to, and encouragingly, so does the research.
Although I have to say, I don't think we'll ever get back to the stage where the Olympic Games are actually held with completely naked athletes, which not a good sight, I don't think, but whatever sort of perspectives. We talked about New Covent Garden Soup. Obviously, they were responsible for this particular survey. Is super good, nutritious food to actually keep you going when you want to be refueling, shall we say?
Absolutely. So for me, I mean, it's my ultimate comfort food for a few reasons. Number one, certainly when you look at the Great British Swim, and it was kind of widely documented when I developed something called salt tongue. So after 12 hours of swimming a day, you know, for 157 days, my tongue basically started to shed skin. And I'm so sorry for anyone listening who's maybe eating their dinner. But for me, that meant that certain foods were kind of off the menu. Like, if you can imagine, like granola or something that's crunchy, it kind of felt like I was chewing on sandpaper. I couldn't quite, you know, it was hard on my palate. Whereas soup for me represented, one, a way that was much kinder on the tongue, but equally as well, it, just in terms of looking at nutrient density, so again, a lot of people mentioned that, you know, I was putting away 10,000 to 15,000 calories a day. So yes, looking after my calorie requirements, but equally, you know, I always said we're not perfect calorie counting equations. That's not what the human body was designed for. Yes, you know, the laws of thermodynamics, calories in versus calories out, they do apply to us humans, but we extract far more than calories from food. You know, it's far more interesting and intricate than that. And, you know, for me, looking at soup, which became my default when swimming around Great Britain, it was just I needed something that was kind on my tongue, provided some calories, but equally was so nutrient dense that it just provided, yes, protein, fats and carbs, but even looking at vitamins, minerals, enzymes, micronutrients, it's just actually being kinder to your body so your body takes care of you, essentially.
Clearly the notion that Jason Momoa was Aquaman, he should have actually stepped aside for your good self, Rog, Ross. Maybe he could be the next Submariner, a whole range of things there.
Yeah, maybe by the time, yeah, I mean, my beard wasn't as impressive, I suppose.
And you didn't have to use a trident when going around the United Kingdom.
That is true, yeah.
Where can people go to find out further information? Where's the best website we should point them to, Ross?
Yeah, for any more information, please go to www.newcoventgardensoup.com, but specifically look at the Soup Up tab, because there is an amazing group of swimmers, the New Covent Garden Soup swimmers, who are just incredible, and it shows that you don't necessarily have to be, you know, swimming around Great Britain, you know, 2,000 miles. That's not what this is about. It's about those everyday moments where, you know, I often say there's no such thing as bad weather. There's just a bad attitude. And I think, you know, the New Covent Garden Soup swimmers, they are a testament to that. And it doesn't matter, come rain or shine, they will go wild swimming. And it's an amazing group of people, and all the research will be presented there as well. So, yeah, please go over to there.
Quite clearly, Ross, your superhero name should be Captain Inspirational. So, I mean, that's the key thing from that point of view. We'll go on that basis. Ross, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. Hopefully we'll speak again soon.
No, bless you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Covent Garden Soup run. That's amazing. I don't know. World's fittest man, I thought, would have been William Sitwell, actually. But I don't know, William, have you ever swum round or even considered swimming round the coast of the UK?
You know, listening to that man this time of day, even though it's barely 9:30, makes you want to pour a drink, doesn't it?
Indeed.
You know what, actually, 3 weeks ago I was in Mousel, down there, beautiful little harbour village in Cornwall, and I swam every morning. Off the rocks.
You're quite into
it. But I swam for about 23 seconds.
Yeah, not that kind of
a paddle then. A bit of a dip.
It's a way forward. That's the critical thing. Dear Megan, a guide to being properly posh in Britain. Have they realised in the House of Windsor that actually they need to call in the heavyweights? They need your input, William, in terms of this package.
Who knows?
Hmm. Yeah. Anyway, is it all about standards? Would you like to share with us, or was it just a case you thought, well, actually, it's time to give her some more advice?
if people want to read the piece, they should just go to the Telegraph and purchase it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you could read the whole thing out and their copyright. Why not?
It's no. I mean, you know, we'll ease back from it. We'll keep it on William Weighs In. A strange rumour abounds that the co-owner and head chef of exciting Wimbledon Village restaurant Black Radish has from childhood always availed himself of a chauffeur. A surprising contrast, perhaps, to his eatery, an affordable and cosy place modelled on the very fashionable Paris Neo-Bistro. But a little detective work provides the answer. His PR did say he was driven from a young age, but she meant passion rather than Bentleys. Ben, you appreciated that, did you not?
Of course I did, yeah. Well, obviously I haven't worked there. It was just a funny joke. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah,
it was
very well written. My own jokes. I thought it was quite funny.
It's all highly positive in every sense of the word. Okay, Ben. Questions for William before I actually ask him his views on whether we should take that nutritionist advice, because earlier in the morning we were speaking to a New York doctor, 3:30 a.m. in New York, who insisted that actually we should go back to that whole routine of having our full dinner at breakfast and basically reversing our meals, flipping our meals.
Well,
for better
I wasn't
health.
too keen on that myself. Although, interesting, I read your piece there on a certain Indian restaurant in London.
Can't mention it. Hasn't scored the 5-star or 4.5 stars that we need to mention.
It's scored less than half that.
Dear.
But yes, interestingly, I was reading the review, and I think the vibe I got from it was, do you think they overcomplicated a lot of their dishes to the point where actually simplicity, especially in Indian cuisine, is often more effective?
I thought they overpriced them. I didn't think they made them overcomplicated.
Oh, to be fair, we saw that as well. And it's about 200, almost, if you add drinks and service, it's about £200 a head. I think that's quite ludicrous to charge.
They charge three small lamb chops grilled on the tandoor, £29. I think that's quite steep for a starter. Or two for 20. I think that's quite a lot. Yeah. And I actually had a bit of a row with them about this because they said, well, they said that they buy them for a fiver each. So I thought, well, who's their supplier? Who's selling the Tamarind restaurant? Chops for £5.
Yeah. Is it a very bespoke lamb that they're looking for? You know, they've actually got bespoke sheep out there saying this is special quality. They just work on that basis.
Who knows?
Lamb, isn't it?
I know that even the best lamb shouldn't be that expensive. So it's hard because if you run a restaurant somewhere like Mayfair and you just spent £16 squillion doing it up, then you've got to somehow try and make your money back. So it's a restaurant for a certain kind of person, frankly. Dan Cherie, my local curry house in Brackley, is a hell of a lot better. Except the Tamarind does serve very, very good dal, which I made very clear in the piece. Lovely,
yes.
Wet dal.
Yeah, we saw that, read that as well, yeah.
There we are.
Yeah, so they could do with changing their ice cream, I think. But yeah, it's interesting. Very interesting.
How's the book coming on, William?
well, did I tell you there was that cartoon years ago in The Spectator where one writer says to another, I'm writing a book, and the other one goes, neither am I. Maybe I've told you that already.
Yeah, I think that's good.
But slowly, and it makes me panic daily.
Oh, don't panic.
At the moment, I'm sort of I'm wandering around with Ibn Battuta, who's an extraordinary 14th century Islamic scholar, and he left home to go to Mecca and came back 30 years later, which is a hell of a year off, hell of a gap year. And went literally from Mombasa to Mogadishu up to Ceylon. The most extraordinary traveller. And he dictated all of his thoughts years later and had the most extraordinary memory. And some people think that some of it was fraudulent, but I think it's unlikely. Anyway, it's an amazing story. So I'm sort of following his travels around in the early part of the 14th century to try and find out what people were eating out and about. Although he tended to eat for free and sort of the hospices run by...
Well, he couldn't afford the lamb chops at the time, could he?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of... Yeah. You know, back in the 14th century, actually, relatively recently, you could travel the world with very little and find the generosity of strangers would sustain you. But these days, it shows how society's changed. If someone bangs on your door wanting a bed for the night and a lamb chop, you bring the police.
Or go to a restaurant in London and they charge you £30.
It's a thought to ponder. I mean, it's almost as profound as Arthur Mackenzie's thought about the heart sees all, indeed. Feels all from that point of view. Any questions from yourself, Eloise?
Not really, but I was just thinking at how many pot noodles you could buy for that £200 and feed a student for an entire year.
There you have it, William. So. You know, I mean, the equivalent. You could actually sort of, you know, have another little column in terms of William Weighs In, which I'm sure the Telegraph editorial staff would appreciate.
Which is, wouldn't it?
Pot noodle equivalent.
We'd add that to Roosevelt's comparison.
It would be very good for your system to only eat pot noodles, and I don't think that £200 worth of pot noodles would get you that far. I don't think it would feed you for an entire year.
I reckon I could make it work.
Yeah, all right. Well.
You reckon, yeah, watered so, down, a bit of grass.
That's true. I suppose you're having one meal a day.
Yeah.
So, William, would you have your dinner as a breakfast?
Yes, this is the point that was being made by Dr. Michael Krupain, author and medical director of the Dr. Oz Show, and he was convinced that actually, in terms of the nutrition, to maximise our diets, you should eat your dinner for breakfast and reverse the whole sort of process.
Yeah, I completely agree. You need to eat progressively less as the day goes on. It's better for digestion. You shouldn't eat too late. You should have a large breakfast, a modest lunch, small tea, and a tiny little light supper. The problem is that doesn't always fit in with modern lifestyles and the fact that people have to rush off and the only time they have to eat is in the evening. But it does go against, I think, the general human metabolism. And I think it's common sense. But, I kind of like a glass of wine with my dinner. Maybe you can... Some people do start the day, you know, good Edwardian claret for breakfast with your kidneys, liver, and so on. Yeah, why not? Well, why don't we? Should we give it a go for a week?
Well, I think it sounds like a challenge.
Write a book on that, then.
Drink backwards as well.
That'd be a good column.
Precisely.
Yeah, have wine in the morning.
Eating
coffee.
Backwards for Easter. A kind of companion to walking backwards for Christmas.
Bloody wake up, have a Bloody Mary, a glass of champagne, exactly. And then a glass of white, nice glass of white burgundy, a glass of claret, and then, what will you do at lunchtime? Lunchtime remains the same because if you swivel it, it's
lunch,
still
isn't it?
There.
Exactly.
And then just a glass of orange juice at night. Sounds very
good. Once again, William Sitwell, perfect symmetry.
Sold
absolutely
it.
Perfect.
Sold it.
Last two questions for William, please. Ben?
Yes, William, have you had a reasonably interesting telephone link for today on the show?
Thank you.
Good.
See what he did there? He reversed it.
He reversed
the whole thing.
He's done the reverse.
Wonderful. Right.
Brilliant. And we would join us again next week.
Yeah, can I go and write my book now, please?
You can go and write your book.
Hearing Day and the importance of hearing and so on. It is World Hearing Day, which is obviously essential when we talk about radio. Apparently 11 to 13 year olds are most at risk of hearing impairment, and to talk about this we're very pleased to actually welcome Paul Checkley, an audiologist from Harley Street. Good morning, Paul. And also John O'Heal from the ACS. Good morning, John O. Excellent. John, can we come to you first? Because obviously you're a musician, you suffer from music-induced tinnitus. That's not a barrel of laughs, is it?
Not really. I'm actually, technically, I'm a retired musician, although I did come out of retirement last summer. But yeah, how I got involved with this was I didn't realise that I could be doing my hearing any damage. 15 years of gigging and touring and sessions and also going through the music education system as well. Music at school, sixth form, a degree in music, even working a couple of years at the BBC. But nobody said that I could be damaging my hearing until it was too late. And I was aware of a ringing or a whistling in my head or in my ears, which people said, oh, that's tinnitus, but it goes away after about 12, 24 hours. And that's kind of what was happening at the time until sort of my mid-late 30s. And then it didn't go away, and I've had it ever since. So I've had chronic tinnitus for a long period of time. And then when I went to an audiologist and had a hearing test, actually realised that I had quite significant noise-induced or music-induced hearing loss. So, yeah, it had a big impact on me professionally and personally as well. So, you're right, it's not a joke for sure.
Paul, turning to your good self, I mean, do we need to watch things like headphone levels, various other bits and pieces? I mean, clearly in the studio we're all wearing headphones at present, but you know, clearly you need to take care of your hearing, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that a lot of people, when we talk about, as Jono just said, when we talk about noise-induced hearing loss, people think of traffic noise or roadworks or factory noise. But the point is that any kind of sound which is at a level that's too high, or if you're in that environment for too long, is going to damage your hearing. So it's just important that people bear that in mind. We know when music is or sounds are too loud for us, But it's just having that awareness that actually they're not just too loud, they could be permanently damaging your hearing.
And in terms of that, is it prevention better than cure? Obviously, are we looking to sort of ensure that as we go to Sunday, which is World Hearing Day on the 3rd of March, that this message gets out more effectively to people?
Absolutely. So there are often, if we leave a very loud environment, we have maybe a dullness to our hearing or maybe a ringing in our ears. That's something we call temporary threshold shift, and that's something, it's really your ears telling you that was too loud. So prevention, that can also become permanent. And when hearing loss or tinnitus, when we develop either of these issues, there's not really anything that can be done for that. So absolutely, prevention is key.
And the days presumably when we always wore it as a badge of honour to actually go to a rock concert and actually have ears bleeding, etc., not to be followed through in any way, shape or form. Very briefly, Eloise, any thoughts on this particular item?
What can we do to prevent this?
Well, exactly. I mean, awareness, education and protection are the three things that I say to people. We need to raise more awareness about hearing conservation, especially in education, especially in music education, of course. But recreational and social listening is a major part of popular culture. You know, there's plenty of stats out there and research to back this up, as well as the information from the World Health Organization. And hearing conservation or awareness about how you can damage your hearing is not embedded into the curriculum in mainstream education or even in music education, I really don't know. I mean, you know, my daughter, she's 12. She's had safe sex education, alcohol awareness, drug awareness, cyber security. And yet, if young people are listening to more music, amplified music and sounds on headphones or going to concerts than ever before, why are we not talking about this in schools? It's crazy.
Very sage and important points there, Paul and Jono. Where can people go to find out further information about what we've been talking about today? Where's the best website to pursue?
Jono, I think at the ACS website we'll have good information on your how to protect your ears with high fidelity earplugs. But the there's always also the British Tinnitus Association or Action on Hearing Loss.
Jono Heal, Director of the ACS, and Paul Checkley, many thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on. Many thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks very much, Alex.
I don't know if I'm scared of dying, but I'm scared of living too fast, too slow. Regret, remorse, hold on, no, no, I gotta go. There's no starting over, no new beginnings, time raises on. Just gotta keep on keeping on. Gotta keep on going, looking straight out on the road. Can't worry about what's behind you, what's coming for you further up the road. Try not to hold on to what is gone. I try to do right what is wrong. I try to keep on keeping on. Yeah, I just keep on keeping on. I hear a voice calling out for me. These shackles I made in an attempt to be free. Something good comes with the bad. A song's never just sad. There's hope. There's a silver line. Show me mine.
Silver lining, very important. And let's hope that we do have a silver lining for our Silver Surfer and a variety of other things, because the loss of independence is leading matters in terms of our general concern for an ageing population. Some of the facts: the UK has an ageing population. Most over 65s still want to live independently, quite rightly so. And this loss of independence is the leading concern for 7 in 10 of the older generation, according to a recent survey of over 4,000 UK adults. Now, to talk about this, we've got two fabulous folk. First of all, from Connected Care at Centrica Hive, the Connected Care Lead. That's Anna Gustafsson. How are you, Anna?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Very good indeed. And also the Director at the Charity Carers UK, Madeline Starr, MBE. Good morning, Madeline.
Hello.
Madeline, if we come to you first with respect to this, I mean, clearly we want to ensure that if you are becoming more chronologically gifted and more experientially enhanced, that you can maintain your independence. But there are a lot of fears that go along with that, presumably.
Absolutely, and I think what was so startling from this Centrica Hive research is how few people are talking about it. So I think the finding that independence in later life is really important for people, I think we'd expect that. But how few people are talking about it in their families and how difficult they find that, I think that's a real concern. And very different concerns in each of those age ranges too. So these are conversations we need to have. We need to make it easier for people to have a difficult conversation and plan ahead.
Just turning to a couple of studio folk, et cetera, start off with Eloise. Eloise, you've got a grandfather. Does he live alone? I mean, from that point of view, what's the sort of situation there?
My grandfather lives with his wife, and my nan lives on her own. My other
so,
yeah,
nan, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so there is. And Ben, any sort of elderly relatives?
Yeah, on both sides. So my grandfather has been by himself since 2007, and my grandma since 1997.
Right. I mean, Anna, this is a kind of common line. It's something we know we're going to be faced with from that point of view in terms of how we're coping with that. Is it a case of we haven't got the extended family as such in our current Western culture, and we need to kind of find some kind of happy medium to coordinate these wishes?
Well, I think people do use and rely on family a lot, and we know that a lot of people do support their elderly relatives and visit them frequently. I think for us, what's interesting is what we can do to help in those relationships, how we can make that everyday worry a little bit easier, and how we can help use and leverage smart technology to help be a tool in those relationships.
So actually embracing the technology, when I use the term silver surfers, which used to be used to talk about people who are getting into technology at a slightly more advanced age from that point of view. Is it? I mean, you talked about conversation there. Do people need to talk within the family to actually say, look, what are your wishes? What do you actually want to sort of be at this particular stage?
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear from the research that there are really different worries in each age group. So people over 65 worried about worrying their children or being a burden. Dreadful, isn't it? What a horrid word for people to feel. And those in that 40 to 60 age range, just not wanting to upset mum or dad, or not wanting to upset nan or grandpa. I think there's something too about just not wanting to think of ourselves or those we love as becoming less independent and facing those life changes. So opening up those conversations is really critical. We're very bad at this, I think, as a society. We kind of close these things off. They're very private. So getting started, helping people to have the conversation is so important. And, you know, we've put together some top tips to get started. But those conversations are going to be very, very different within families, each one of whom will be facing, you know, very, very individual situation. But there are now things out there that we can use to get that conversation going. And I think the smart technology is a brilliant place to start.
Mm. I mean, one of the really encouraging things from the research that we found was that there's actually quite a lot of interest and belief that this could be of help and an openness among the over 65s to consider a solution that could be of help to them.
Well, interesting enough, we'll be talking to the Editor-in-Chief of Trusted Reviews about the Mobile World Conference and Congress discussing the launch of 5G taking place in Barcelona at this very moment, and who knows, that could impact. I did have a little smile in terms of the top concerns for the over 65s. I mean, a lot of very important: loss of independence, becoming frail, immobile, etc. Number 15, having more wrinkles.
I love that one.
It's going to happen. Ben, any final thoughts for yourself?
Yeah. How would you perhaps encourage independent people, independent sort of elderly people, to get more out there if they want to? So would it be like local community groups or having more sort of getting to know your neighbours or anything like that?
Absolutely. All of those things. So family are incredibly important, and anything that can help keep families connected is great. But where you are, you know, the place in which you live, the community that you're taking part in is really important. So every opportunity, you know, knock on that door, get to know your neighbour, find the local group. That does what you want. I think we've got to kind of lift ourselves away from thinking about activities for older people and think about older people doing fab things that they love.
Excellent. A point in which to draw the conversation to a close for this moment at least. Best place to go to find out further details, where would you recommend?
We've got a page up at www.carersuk.org/staying-independent. That's a great place to start.
Madeline Starr and Anna Gustafson, many thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Something loving, I just don't remember the thrill of affection. I just don't remember.
Say something loving,
I need a reminder. The feelings escaped me.
Been anyone's kiss, throwing my arms at no one. When I gave up, I found love.
The thought flows through my mind, and it's growing all the time. I do myself a disservice to feel this weak, to be this nervous.
You say something loving.
So overwhelming, the thrill of affection feels so unfamiliar. You say something loving, without hesitation, it hits me, hits me. It feels so unfamiliar.
Well, the XX might be saying, say something loving. We need to ask the question, of course, what is 5G? How is it going to affect people? People are still having to be with 4G, let alone 5G. That's the usual line from that point of view. To talk about what's happening in Barcelona at this very present in time, a moment in time, the Mobile World Conference, who better than the editor-in-chief, effectively, of Trusted Reviews, the wonderful Nick Merritt. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning.
So, Barcelona, obviously, great things happening there, no doubt, in terms of the Mobile World Conference. But new research has revealed that fewer than one in five consumers are fully aware of what the benefits of 5G will actually be. So share with us this latest generation of mobile connectivity. Will it solve Brexit?
Well, will anything? So I think it's very interesting. There's been a lot of talk about 5G over the last few years, really, and Mobile World Congress has started to bring it together because it's the first time that the phones that will actually enable it have come onto the market. So Samsung, for example, have a new 5G phone that they're prepping, as do LG and Huawei. So the big manufacturers are starting to introduce this hardware, and the services that are being trialed across 4 regional capitals and 12 other cities this year. From next year, really, people will be able to start using it.
Again, as with all of these kind of things, there's a sort of notion that this is going to be the fantastic thing from that. What about the line about people saying, we still have difficulty with 4G, 3G as it isn't working, and of course this never-ending drive to actually be faster, fitter? I mean, does this mean we'll have whole movies downloadable in literally microseconds?
That's right. Well, I suppose it depends on your point of view, really. I mean, lots and lots of people like to be able to access high-resolution content on trains if they're commuting in, for example, or they want more reliability from their connection. But, for example, if you're connecting in in 5G, you could connect 10 times faster than on 4G. So if you're downloading a movie or playing a game, that's quite a significant improvement. But it's also worth bearing in mind that there's more to it than this. So 5G is more about just your phone and working a bit quicker. It's about enabling new services in the future, and it's about enabling more devices to be able to become smarter and connected to the internet as well.
Now, one of the Midweek Drive awesome aspects is when Ben Lewis goes out and about with respect to Signet PR and a whole variety of other bits and pieces with your mobiles and so on. Ben, you've had a look at the sort of findings of this, some of the whole thing. Questions for yourself?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. You know I did my year out
Bentley.
Exactly. Yes, and not just at Bentley, but in the general car industry, 5G was being looked at as a tool to have in cars. Or certainly the power, the same amount of power as 5G. Now, I find it quite interesting because, I mean, we've had no problems so far with 4G. What's the need to go into 5G? Is it more convenience in terms of just quicker speeds and things like that? Or is it essentially being able to cope with the technology that we've got and how technology is increasing in size but it's also in power?
Well, so, yes, there's obviously the benefits of having a faster connection to the internet. And if you'd ask somebody back in the day what difference would a quicker internet connection make, people wouldn't be able to tell you about streaming video and sort of social networks on your phone that are connected always at the same always on and all those sorts of things. So it's quite hard to sort of get a view or predict what might happen in the future. But some of the things that people have talked about are driverless cars, for example. So you need a connection like 5G to make driverless cars a reality. You can't do that with 4G because it's not quick enough or reliable enough. There will be other things that you can do. You can connect more smart devices to the internet. So local councils will be able to roll out smart services now to homes. And this is not something that's going to happen right away, but it's more about the near future.
In terms of that whole notion of, say, the cynic who might be listening to this and saying, yeah, it'll only be a matter of time before they go for 6G and then 7G, would you say, no, you need to get in on 5G, et cetera? Or is it a case of that's the nation of progress? It's no longer sort of Windows 2.0. We've progressed from that.
Well, I think there's 6G and so on. Who knows? I think that 5G will be really, really quick and will enable an awful lot of benefits. I think probably... it's more about the practical nature of it sort of coming up. So we were looking at in our research about what people wanted to know about, and obviously the big question mark is about phone bills. So 15% were worried about their phone bills would increase. So I think that people are becoming aware of it and are starting to ask themselves the practical type questions about what it means for them. It's more about that now than maybe about are you stuck on this treadmill of being forced to go faster. At the end of the day, 5G is a choice, and nobody's going to be required to have a 5G phone.
And certainly the first 5G-enabled phones are now coming to the marketplace. You've got a whole range of other bits and pieces, so you need to obviously be prepared to pay a little bit more. Would you suggest, Nick, that trustedreviews.com would be the more appropriate place if people are actually wanting to find out more about 5G and also the impact it might have on them?
Well, we've done a bunch of research, and of course we're going to be reporting on 5G as we go. If you go to trustedreviews.com/news/5G, you'll find a load of information there.
Nick, as we knew, it would be a perfect way to actually wrap up a programme with respect to how technology can be used to assist folk in many ways, together with, of course, Trusted Reviews. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us? Has it been okay for you?
It's been absolutely fine, thank you very much.
So, you see, it's constant sort of customer satisfaction, smiley face and so on. Would you be kind enough to return again in the near future?
I'll be very happy to.
Lisa, lift up your head. Light up a cigarette in the morning light. You're not so hard. Lisa, come talk to me. I want to hear your memories. You know I've thought of you from time to time. Lying with your makeup off, I can see the girl I love. Dark and brooding, fickle and demure. And I think still, after all these years. Oh, I think still. Don't be shy. This is not a real life. This moment will soon be lost in time.
And have we finished? Well, not quite, because we've still got a few exciting things to mention, including the fact that some of our fine folk from public relations at the University of Lincoln have actually, they're in Barcelona, Ben, quite literally.
Yeah, at the Mobile World Congress, with what we've just been discussing.
Give them a name check, go on.
Cali Sabi and Jess.
Jess and Callie.
Jess and Callie, and exactly. Someone else, but I've forgotten Jeff's.
They'll be there, it's all right.
She won't like that.
Short term memory. It's a sign of aging. We have been covering aging. Let's talk about something else which is very exciting that takes place with legends. Lincoln City legends playing the British Heart Foundation team tomorrow night, March the 1st.
The Memorial Cup. So that's taking place at Lincoln United's ground on Ashby Avenue. Kickoff 7:30. Tickets are £2 for adults and under 16s are free. So feel free to come along. I'll be there, but I mean that probably deter people. But I'll be there, and everyone else will be there from Signet and from British Heart Foundation and Lincoln City, with refreshments, canteen, and a lot.
Tickets are astoundingly low. I think £2.
£2. They are indeed £2
to see some Lincoln City legends and cheer on the British Heart Foundation as they go for this annual Peter Burr Memorial Cup.
Yes.
Which is going to be
7:30 tomorrow evening.
You might even meet his son Gary Burr, who
probably
put the whole thing together. Thanks to Eva McDonald. No, she wasn't in. She's driving. Watch out, Lincolnshire. Thanks to Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy, Eloise Sheehan, Jasmine Foley, of course. Who is Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy? Let's get this correct. Eloise Sheehan,
It's just going.
Thanks to Eloise Sheehan. Thanks to Miss Lincolnshire Galaxy, also known as Jasmine Foley. Thanks to Ben Lewis. Thanks to Phil Leonis. Thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Dr. Michael Cuprain, and Arthur McKenzie, Dr. Chris Steele, Ian McIntosh, Ross Edgsey, William Sitwell, Nick Merritt.
Alex Lefchuk.
There we are. And let us not forget, of course, our wonderful Anna Gustafson, Madeline Starr, and the folk from the British Hearing Foundation and Tinnitus and so on. That's it. We're out of here. Back again on Wednesday. Tallulah Rendell's back with us on Wednesday. We've also got Kieran Moore from Starburst Magazine, a whole heap of other goodies as well. Stay tuned to Siren. Later on today, Soundlinks Showcase, a new awesome show just after 7 o'clock featuring the best of Soundlinks, are all coming through the whole system. And the news will be coming up in a matter of, well, I mean, we've got a minute, really, Ben. We've got 2 minutes to actually fill until the news actually launches. So, having said all that, we could have a song. We could have a mini song. What do you fancy? Blue Moon?
Yep, go for it.
Really? Seriously? Matt Munro? Okay. Well done. Well done to Sergio Aguero, and well done to the Carabao Cup winners.
Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me say, someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms could ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. When I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Moon, now I'm no longer alone, without a dream.